Welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairymen. We're broadcasting from our Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson, at the historic W.D. Horde & Sons Company building commissioned by Wisconsin's 16th Governor W.D. Horde. Our conversation today will focus on dairy demand through 2022. I'm pleased to have four great analysts on this episode of Dairy Livestream to share their insights on this important topic. As a reminder to everyone in our audience, this webcast will be available on our Hordes Dairymen YouTube channel 24 hours after the live event. Dairy Livestream is also available anywhere you'd like to listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Search for Dairy Livestream for the convenience of your smartphone and download it. As you hear from our panelists today, please submit your questions into your GoToWebinar question panel. The earlier you ask a question, the more likely it will get asked on the air. Let's go straight to our first poll question as we talk about, will dairy demand hold through 2022? Before hearing from Mike Brown, we will answer this poll question. What took place last month as it relates to dairy demand? And this is in the United States. Consumers spent 3% more on dairy products. Consumers bought 3% less product. All of the above, or none of the above. So go ahead and answer that. We'll give people a little bit of time. I will, as you're answering that, I will tell you there a hint. There's a good news and not good news story part of this poll question. So we're well over halfway here. Boy, the audience is very interactive today. We appreciate that. We're almost at 70%. So let's go ahead and see those results. And the correct answer is all of the above. The good news is consumers spent 3% more on dairy products. The not good news, consumers in the U.S. spent less, 3% less on dairy products. We welcome Mike Brown to Dairy Livestream, and Mike might just be one of the more unique individuals in our dairy industry. He's seen the dairy sector from about every angle possible. As a member of the Virginia Tech Dairy Cattle Judging Team in college, this ag economist then went on to work for National All Jersey for 11 years and then went to Dairy Gold, where he headed up member services for that Pacific Northwest Dairy Co-op. And then he spent nearly 8 years with Glanbia, and now he is director of supply chain for the Kroger company, the dairy portion of the supply chain. Mike, you watch a host of metrics to track dairy demand. What are you seeing?
Well, your survey question is really hitting the nail on the head. Sales are up, volumes are down. And I would, if I have a concern right now is that the increased cost of dairy products really hasn't been fully transferred into retail at this point in time. There's always a lag, that's the case now. The Kroger stores have run butter specials over the last 2 weeks, which were basically 70 cents, $1.20 below our cost, because they were planned far out and ahead, and that's just the way it is. And it's kind of hard to know because we didn't have high consumer inflation back in 2014, but if you go look back when costs rose at that point in time, we saw exactly the same thing. We saw some modest decline in sales units, but we saw increases in revenue due to those higher costs. So not, I guess kind of predictable. I think one thing that's a little different this time is just the overall inflation rate and the effect on the consumer's pocketbook. As we look at that, we think that's maybe neutralizes some of the demand effect from the retail side, because we expect consumers will be probably making more meals at home as their budgets for eating out may be a little more limited. The three of us, your three industry folks here, we're all at the American Dairy Products Institute meeting this last couple of days, and the big question for everybody is prices are high. There's some instability in world markets, but there's also not a lot of expectation for increased supply of milk. And what's that going to mean in the longer term? Right now, butter futures are below current CME prices, but that is by no means a sure thing. I think there's a lot of concern on price risk, and also I think bigger than ever, supply risk. What's the U.S. industry going to be doing in the next few months? I personally think it looks like good times, relatively speaking, for the Midwest because of water and as well as growing a lot of forage. Because I think, we're going to be in that period of time again where we're going to have very high cash costs. So we're, from the standpoint of the farm, or standpoint of Kroger, we expect to have continued some increases in retails. What Kroger and most retailers, we've talked about this before, generally do, when you have these kind of periods of increased prices, what you generally do is you run less aggressive promotions. But I think these are so drastic, these increases. We are seeing retails list. I did a, Corey, when I got back yesterday from Chicago, I did a casual survey of local grocery stores here in Kenosha, Wisconsin. So by no means a national survey. And what I call the white tag, which is the everyday price of butter, range from $3.49 to $4.69 in large grocery stores. So some are passing on the cost and some aren't. I can tell you right now, landed cost during a store is going to be north of $3 by the time you pay for packaging and transportation. So compared to a couple of years ago, you're going to see those increases. Cheese, we kind of did that in 2020 when we had the big spikes in the fall of 2020 and the summer on cheese prices. And once retails go up, it's difficult at times. They're sticky going up, but they're also sticky coming down. And what we have seen with cheese is we've seen very little relaxing of retail price. We continue to see strong promotions when the margins allow it. Again, right now, they're a little tough. The other thing we're seeing is packaging. We aren't even offering all of our cheese items at this time because we can get the cheese, but we can't get the packaging film printed to manufacture it and deliver it. We run two cheese cut and wrap plants. So it's very strange times, the shortage of supply, and then of course, just the cost of goods are both hurting availability of products in some cases, and are going to be harder on consumers' pocketbooks. It's inevitable with these kind of prices, that's going to happen.
Thanks, Mike. We're going to go to another poll question, and we're going to invite Ted Jacoby here next. And our viewers are going to be like, why are we talking egg yolks? But go ahead and answer the question, and we'll explain this. Egg yolks are a key ingredient in custard. What happened to the price of egg yolks? And this is as of March, things have evolved even more in April. Held steady, dropped, nearly tripled, or none of the above. So, and actually we already updated this. So go ahead and answer that poll question here, because through March, the answer was a little different than April. So let's go ahead and cut that poll question off. And the price of egg yolks has nearly tripled from late March to April here, according to USDA data. The supply chain issues have come about due to avian influenza outbreak that has caused the depopulation of chicken farms. And based on the last numbers I've seen, it's almost in 20 states. That means a semi-load of egg yolks could be fetching, they are fetching, well over $100,000, and that will drive up the cost of frozen dairy products heading into the summer season. It's my pleasure to welcome Ted Galloway to Dairy Livestream. Ted is Vice President of Galloway & Company and General Manager for its Classic Mix Partners. Ted is part of a third generation of Galloways to lead the family business. The Galloway Company creates a diverse mix of complex dairy ingredients and ranks among the largest manufacturers of sweetened condensed milk, dairy beverage bases, and dairy dessert mixes, and that's where these egg yolks come in. These ingredients are part of the formulas used to manufacture some of the most famous food brands consumed in the United States. Ted, can you tell us how you've been juggling shipments and how that's been relating to dairy demand?
Well, it's a real pleasure to be on the podcast today. Juggling, I'm not a good juggler. I probably, if I was juggling eggs, there'd be broken eggs, but we can't afford to do that because we need all the yolks. The supply chain has been very tricky. I was explaining to one customer who said, boy, things are so calm. We don't see anything going on. Why aren't you being affected? And I said, that's what you pay us to do. But every day, what you don't see is the manure show going on here. There have been times where obtaining cream has, because we bring in enough milk and fractionate it to manufacture most of our products, but to stay in balance, we usually are a little deficit on cream or solids every week. There have been weeks where it was just hand to mouth to get another tanker of cream to continue to manufacture all the orders. but it goes even much deeper in the ag industry than just dairy. As mentioned, the avian flu hopefully isn't going to be as bad as in 15, but there are about 9 different flight paths coming across the U.S. when the migrating birds head back north. And of course, they're pooping all the way, and that's what is spreading the avian flu. And depending where your eggs are coming from, which flight path, depends how it's been affected, and the ripple effect is quite serious. So it seems to be slowing down, but we still have plenty of time before the birds are done migrating and the damage is done. Sucrose, which table sugar that's in most food, the growers are getting quite nervous. A lot of the major growing consortiums are already 75% sold out for 23, and the seeds are just going in the ground. And when you look at growing areas such as the Northwest and Colorado, they're in severe drought. So will those seeds ever germinate, and how healthy will the tubers for sugar beets be is a real question. Freight, you go right down the line, everything that we're manufacturing and everything that we need either to get it here or to get it to the customer is under severe stress right now. So I'd like to say that my hair was brown this morning and something happened since then, but it's just the circumstances of daily life.
Thank you, Ted. We will go to another poll question here before we hear from Ted Jacoby. Consumer prices for food climbed 8.8% in March. That's the highest gain since when? All the months are May. So May 1981, May 1991, May 2001, May 2011, or May 2021. So go ahead and answer that question. And so much time has passed here that we may actually have some viewers online that really don't even remember a few of those years, because it's quite a range in terms of over the decades. But we have seen high food inflation before, but it's been some time. So we're getting some strong response here. We'll go ahead and see the results. And indeed, it was when Ronald Reagan was president in his first term in office, so all the way back to May 1981. Those are the inflationary numbers we're seeing, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. They gather this data monthly. And food inflation is a big topic on everyone's mind. It's not only impacting U.S. domestic markets, but global markets too. When it comes to global demand, Ted Jacoby has been working with America's top exporters for a number of decades. After starting his career with Bongard's Creameries, Ted transitioned to the T.C. Jacoby Company in 1996, just 2 years after NAFTA was inked, and today we would call that the USMCA, and just 1 year after the U.S. Dairy Export Council was launched, Ted began working out of the company's recently opened Mexico City office. And for those who follow dairy exports, you know that Mexico is our best customer these days. And certainly Ted was on the front lines early on in that journey. Ted has seen the dairy markets from many sides throughout his career, and this is his third appearance on Dairy Livestream. I'm looking forward to hearing Ted's insight regarding, will dairy demand hold through 2022? Ted, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Corey, and thanks for inviting me to join you guys again. So the first thing I'd say about export demand is I'd almost divide the world into you've got developed countries and you've got developing countries. And I think discretionary spending, as we're looking at global inflation, this isn't just a U.S. phenomenon, I think those developing countries are going to start to feel that pinch and have already started to feel that pinch much more than developed countries. Here in the United States, I think we're starting to see a little bit of our discretionary spending drop off, at least anecdotally from what I've heard. But food prices are not going to be the first thing that consumers cut. I think in developing countries, that's a little bit different. Dairy in particular is considered to be a luxury food, which means especially in developing countries like Mexico, people trade up for dairy. one of the things we're seeing internationally right now, the biggest issue the last few years has been logistics. People have talked a lot about that. But today, right now, the lockdowns in China are starting to have a big effect on exports. They just recently announced that Beijing is now being locked down as well as China. We're starting to see some pushback on shipments, on sales that were closed many months ago that were supposed to ship. We're starting to see some of that product be getting diverted elsewhere, like Mexico. And, you know, Mike and Ted and I were all in Chicago the last few days for the ADPI. And the tone at the ADPI was a little bit different than I expected. I expected people to be thinking more about further upside because supply continues to be restricted. But more of what the talk was different places where we're starting to see demand pushback because we've had these high prices for quite a few months now. So that's it's going to be interesting to see how sustainable it is. Supply is going to continue to be restricted. But we are seeing pushback on the export side.
Thank you, Ted. And that industry meeting that they were talking about that they were attending is the American Dairy Product Institute. So it's quite a gathering place for people that specialize in dairy products. So we've got one more poll question here before we hear from Andy Novakovic. What was true about food prices in March 2022? Again, this is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At-home food purchases rose faster at 10%. Away-from-home food prices rose faster at 6.9%. Both at-home and away-from-home rose at 8.8% or none of the above. So go ahead, and this one's going to maybe surprise a few people. This is, again, this is data that the U.S. federal government comes up with every month here, and you can subscribe to these lists. I went through and did that, but the smorgasbord is 200 plus, so it takes a while to pluck through what you want and what you don't want. But I think this is, we'll be, and Andy can expound on this a little bit. So let's go ahead and cut this poll question off. And the correct answer is actually the first one there. At-home food purchases rose faster at 10%. And part of that in play, and Andy's more seasoned economist than me, but you know, the other one, when you start looking at restaurants, you have labor in there as well. That has been inflating as well, but not as much as food lately. So Andy, welcome back to Dairy Livestream. Can you tie these thoughts together as well, dairy demand hold through 2022? And before you go ahead and answer that, we're getting some audience questions in, but go ahead and type those into the GoToWebinar control panel, because after Andy speaks, we will start answering your questions about dairy demand. Go ahead, Andy. You're on mute.
Okay, here I am. Hope it's worth it. I'd like to zoom out a little bit and look at some of the bigger items that are moving this all along. And Mike and the two Teds actually really touched on several of these topics. We are in an inflationary period. This isn't just about the price of milk by any stretch of the imagination. And everybody who's farming or in any kind of business is well aware of that situation. When you look at inflationary periods and ask the question, what is driving a general increase in prices that's experienced across all sectors or darn near all sectors, it pretty much boils down to two major items that have to do with the government. One is deficit spending. We push more dollars out than we collect in taxes. That tends to spur consumption. Depends, of course, what the nature of the deficit spending is. But we've given, in the last couple of years, we've given an awful lot of additional support to consumers in the form of various kinds of programs, some direct cash, some abatement of student loans, and just a host of things. And that adds income into the economy, largely spurring consumption. A certain amount of investment, maybe, but largely spurring consumption on the part of households that are probably benefiting from this deficit spending. As was noted, we in those kind of periods we see staple goods holding pretty tight in terms of sales, number of purchases, items purchased, but we back off on discretionary. So we fix the car instead of buying a new one. God bless you, you can even find a new one, and so on. The second big policy is monetary policy. And that one's getting all the attention because, frankly, we haven't been any good at fiscal policy, or at least having the discipline to get our fiscal house in order. So it kind of leaves it up to the Fed, which is run by people who aren't elected, which probably gives them a little bit easier time doing what they do. And we're starting to see some tightening up on that. That tends to have more of an investment effect as opposed to a consumption effect. Probably will hit businesses a little bit harder than deficit spending issues would normally, but certainly also hits households. Those two things come in place, and you know, to bring back inflation, we could do it with fiscal policy, but chances are that's not going to work because we don't have the will to do it, and so we're going to see a lot more talk about the Fed increasing interest rates, because that's kind of like the only one-sided game in town right now. And of course, the Fed is talking about that. I would remind folks that while that's true and probably not a comforting thought for a lot of us, we are so far away from the interest rate regimes that we saw in the 70s, which was the big inflationary period that's at least still within the lifetimes of a few of us. That's not funny. We had 18% mortgage rates, 18.18. It's like a credit card rate on mortgages back at that time. So the good news is we're not remotely there. The supply side can also give us inflationary effects, and we're definitely seeing that. Energy prices are spiking, largely because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We've had labor costs spiking from before that, very much a pandemic effect. Energy and labor are so fundamental to everything in the whole economy that those are going to have powerful effects. And again, for those of us that lived through the 70s, energy prices were a gigantic part of what spurred that inflation. We had deficit spending with the Vietnam War, and a few other things that were part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society initiatives. But the getting OPEC together and seeing the rapid rise in energy prices was a huge engine that spurred that inflationary period, which rambled on through into the Reagan administration, even though it started in the Nixon administration. Those are going on, and getting a grip on those effects are going to be quite a different challenge for us. If you look at this inflationary period that we're coming into, although it has some aspects that are similar to the inflation period of the 70s, largely the energy drive, the labor part and a lot of the transportation and logistics stuff, that supply chain stuff that others have mentioned, really is a lot more reminiscent of the inflation post-World War II, which was probably the second biggest inflationary period in the 20th century. I say this to point out that we've got all kinds of moving parts here. The World War II experience was that the supply chain recovered and we got through that part and adjusted. And I'm hopeful that we'll figure it out with our current supply chain issues. The energy part of the 70s took a little longer to sort out, and a lot of that hinges on the very unpredictable factor of what Russia's going to do, and oh, by the way, what we're going to do to Russia. A second item that I want to touch on was also mentioned by a couple of folks, and that is people experience inflation in remarkably different ways and to different degrees. And it doesn't take any genius to understand that the low-income single mom living in a rural area or in an urban center is an entirely different situation from you know, the kind of lifestyle that Corey is used to. So household incomes and what we can do to protect folks who are vulnerable is going to make a huge difference. We had some huge special programs during the pandemic. It's going to be, we're going to have to see, what do we do now? SNAP, school lunch, other forms of government assistance are kind of a bedrock, and I suspect we're going to see those come into play. The last thing I want to touch on, Corey mentioned a couple of year-over-year numbers on price inflation that were pretty startling. The data that I'm looking at is not this month compared to a month a year ago, but more of a kind of a longer-term comparison. The U.S. Department of Labor does these data, and they use 1982 to 84 as their base period. That's 40 years ago. It sounds like a long time, but it doesn't matter so much. It's just a comparison point. That's when the index equals 100. If you look at the all CPI, all retail prices, we're now at 2.9 times what we saw in that base period. There are several items, big category items that are above that. Fruits and vegetables, retail fruits and vegetables are above that. Food away from home is above that. Grains, cereals, and bakery products are above that. Meat, poultry, fish, and eggs are above that. Dairy is below. Not below by a lot, but it's below. Mike mentioned that sometimes it takes a little while before grocery stores kind of catch up. They sort of resist price increases for a variety of reasons, but eventually the adjustment is made. Fruits and vegetables, grain, cereals, and bakery, meat, poultry, fish, and eggs have their own sector issues in addition to the inflationary ones. But I think that's probably good news for dairy, at least in terms of our share of the market basket. If you look at individual dairy items, all dairy is up 2.4 times that base year. Cheese is up 2.7. Milk is actually up 1.6. So although the increase in milk is eye-catching, it still represents a pretty good buy compared, I'd say a very good buy compared to lots of other things we see in the grocery store. So, Corey, there's a lot of moving parts here, a lot of different levers that government can pull on and push on, a lot of different strategies that businesses can use to deal with this, and a lot of different strategies for households that we're going to have to be thinking about as we go forward. It isn't going to be easy to untangle this ball of yarn, and some parts will be untangled a little bit more graciously, gracefully than others.
Thank you, Andy. We're going to go to the question and answer portion of this webcast. And before we turn to our first question here, one of our online listeners asked for the link for those Bureau of Labor Statistics. So if you're listening online right now, I pushed that out there along with some of the direct quotes from that page. So you can go ahead and source that information. And as a reminder to our audience, you can use the GoToWebinar control panel. Go ahead and type your question. We see those here in our web broadcasting room here, and we'll get those out. Mike, Ted Galloway, and Ted Jacoby, you all referenced attending the American Dairy Products Institute meeting here, and I think our audience here would really like to hear some of your takeaways. I believe a couple of you said they were a little more bearish in some of their commentary from the people that were attending there than you had anticipated. Maybe Ted Jacoby, if you want to start with that, and then we'll hear from Mike and Ted Galloway.
Sure, happy to. So I went into the ADPI thinking, okay, prices are high, but supply is restricted. We're in the middle of the time of year when milk production is at its peak, so we're in the flush. So you'd expect a little bit of heaviness, but as we get into the heat of the summer, prices are going to need to go higher because of the restriction in supply. That is not the tone of the conversations that I had. The tone of most of the conversations that I had were, we're not seeing quite the pull through in butter that we expected. We're not seeing the export demand for whey powder that we expected. We're not seeing the demand for non-fat that we expected. And in some cases on the non-fat sector, we actually were hearing of some sales that were even canceled that was pushing product back into the United States. And so the last 3 weeks or so, we've seen prices pull down, especially in the powder sector. And my attitude going in was, this is a temporary blip. We're in the middle of the flush, but the flush doesn't seem to be as long as it usually is. There seems to be a little bit more substance behind that when it comes to why prices are pulling back. Having said that, a good example of the kind of conversations I had with many of our, especially our international customers was, I don't have a lot of inventory. I'm going to buy what I need when I need it, but I don't want to build inventories price level. So especially when you're talking about Mexico, so Mexico can live much more in a close to a just-in-time type of environment than, let's say, China, where you've got to figure out how to get it all the way there. And with the labor challenges that we've had, in especially ocean freight, they've got to plan as much as 6 months ahead of time. They don't need to do that in Mexico. So in Mexico, we were hearing a lot of, we don't like these prices. We're going to wait and buy when we need to, but we don't have anything in inventory. And that is a bit of an indication that demand may be decent in the second half of the year, but I don't think it's going to run away from us, because everybody is very leery about how high the prices are, and people are seeing pushback at the consumer level with these prices.
Mike Brown?
I think one of the things we pull, first of all, we buy millions of pounds of dry products for our manufacturing plants every year, so we meet with all of our suppliers, including folks like Ted, which is always good to get a feel for the market. Another thing we try to pull from that meeting is our risk management, price management strategies. And to Ted's point, it was a little confusing. We went in too thinking, boy, tight, 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 and I still think we're going to be tight. But when you look at some of the reasons, so much of it is logistics. Canceled orders simply because they can't get it there. Certainly China's new bout with COVID is playing a role. They've pretty much shut down, but they can turn back on too when they need to. But I really believe that when you look at world markets for milk, and people are sometimes surprised we pay so much attention to that at Kroger, because we're a domestic company and actually buy very little imported products, is the effect it has on price. We're now a supplier of that market. And New Zealand's declining and Europe's declining. We have an opportunity for a bigger role if we can get it on a container on a ship to where it needs to go. And that's a big part of the strategy moving ahead. So our takeaway from that meeting was when I look at the deviation of our projections for future prices, they're the widest they've ever been, because of this variance, which means that when we look at our different forecasts that we work with, which means that you tell me, I mean, we look at take September butter, for example, we have a 70 cent range between our forecasts that we use. So, and give me a dartboard and I'll tell you which one I think's right. It's just very, very difficult. So it makes it harder to plan. We do think there's still some supply risk later in the year, particularly for butter. Isn't only a price management, it is a supply management issue. And we're actually putting away more packaged butter earlier than we normally would, just because we want to make sure we have supply for fourth quarter. Fourth quarter butter sales are basically doubled any other quarter of the year. So you don't want to mess up in November and December on butter.
Ted Galloway, what are you seeing and hearing?
Well, our team, I did not go to EDPI because someone has to run the show. But our team down there, we were assuring our customers is that we endeavor every day to make sure that we have what we need to produce the products that they sell to people like Mike Brown. And the difficulty is just rolling with the punches, because some of the component costs I mentioned earlier, transportation and packaging, are increasing so rapidly, they're even hard to understand. I mean, a year ago, we could send a semi to the West Coast for $3,000. Now it's $6,000 or more to go to the Northeast part of the country. A semi is actually $10,000 to get to Maine right now, just astronomical. And so it's trying to keep people calm, have them realize that we can manufacture. Things are tight, but we endeavor not to, in the end, not be able to make their product. But it's almost the uncontrollable components that we don't know day to day. Can we actually find a freight company to get an order to a customer? And this is becoming everyday reality. And I think Andy brought up an excellent point about the stratification of purchase decisions for different economic groups in the country. And we'd kind of like our endless winter to stop too, because that's affecting our dairy dessert business.
You know, and our audience members probably know we have a dress rehearsal a couple days before the game day here. And one of the things that we were talking about during that, we're not scripted here, of course, but we just want to hear what we're going to be talking about. Some ports, particularly in the United States, are struggling more than others to move product. In fact, it's been reported that some buyers will not even take delivery at certain ports. Do you have some specific working examples? I don't, Ted Galloway, if you want to start with that, or Ted Jacoby, it's up to you.
We, one of our friends in the business, the dairy industry, we've all known each other for a long time, a friend in the business who had a multi-million dollar piece of equipment coming over from Europe. Normally that would have been delivered in the New York area ports. In order for them to efficiently get it in the country and up to their plant to be installed, it went to Houston, where they could get it into the port immediately and transport it efficiently. There was transportation available, and I'm sure Ted Jacoby has even better horse stories than that one.
Many, unfortunately. But what I will say specifically about how people are changing around ports. So the two ports that are having the most problems are the two California ports, Long Beach / LA and Oakland. A good example of what's happening is historically, as whey powder would come out of cheese plants in the upper Midwest like Wisconsin, it would go west and it would eventually leave through Long Beach or Oakland. Today, a lot of those containers are going south and getting loaded out of Houston. So that's kind of, but I would say this, that's the beginning of the problem. The next part of the problem is, while those two US ports are really struggling, the transload ports in Asia are struggling even more. And what I mean by transloads, think of it kind of like if you're on an airline. You have your direct flights, and then you have your flights where you go through a hub. Well, it's the containers that go through a hub, a transload port, where it's really struggling. Because first you got to get it on a container ship. Well, first you got to get it in a container. That's a struggle. Then you got to get it to the port in time to get it on a ship. That's been a struggle. Then you got to get the ship to the transload port. Now you got to get it off the off that ship, and then you got to get it on the next ship so you can get it to your destination port. That's been a problem. And when you add the bottlenecks that's going on at every step in the process, I would describe it as this: domestically, logistically, prices are more expensive. That's not pleasant. But at the end of the day, I can get the product from point A to point B. It's just going to cost me a lot more. When I'm dealing with our international freight, I would say the average rescheduling of shipments that go in containers right now is somewhere between 4 and 5, which means, hey, I got a container, but I couldn't get it on the ship, so I had to cancel and reschedule. Oh, I got the container, I got it loaded on the container, but the ship is already gone, I got to wait for the next ship. Oh, guess what? I got it on the ship. Now it's in a transload port, but I missed the connection because this ship was delayed. These things are happening to everybody, not just the dairy industry, to everybody. And so what used to take 3 months between when we got an international deal done and when our customers got the product, it's 9 months now. It's easily three times as long. And that's not changing. Now what's happening today is you're having the COVID outbreak in China. You know, some of the biggest ports in the world are those Chinese ports. We were talking about, oh my gosh, we've got 100 ships waiting to get unloaded in Long Beach, the longest line ever. They're talking about the amount of ships in line to get unloaded in some of those Chinese ports, closer to 1,000. They're really backed up. And one of my compatriots in the dairy industry who does a lot of exporting made a comment while I was at ADPI that kind of took me by surprise because I didn't think of it this way. I was kind of making the assumption, okay, we know how big that the port bottleneck has been in the US. Now China's gonna have that problem. This could be a really big deal. But the question is gonna be, and I don't know the answer to this, in the US, We're more automated. We have the Longshoremen's Union. They have their own policies and procedures on how they load and unload ships, and you pretty much got to play by their rules. China's a little bit, you know, they probably have 10 times the amount of people involved in every single unloading. They're probably less automated. The possibility exists that they get to get through their logjam a little bit quicker than we will here in the US. I don't know the answer to that, but that's going to be the big question, because if those Chinese ports continue to be logjammed the way our US ports were, this is a problem that's going to go on for a long time. If they can get unjammed quickly, then maybe things ease up quickly. And we don't know the answer to that. And that's uncertainty. And uncertainty is usually not good for a market.
And there's supply chain issues like this everywhere. I flew through the Baltimore airport four times in the last 10 days, and a couple of flight attendants under their breath were calling it bagless Baltimore. Every one of my flights on an airline was delayed over an hour because there's just not enough people at the airport loading bags. So the flights are delayed, people are on the planes, but those are some of the things. Andy, we got a number of questions coming in here. We're going to turn this one to you, and then Ted and Mike can jump in. Do you think China is locking down to try to reset their inflation and costs instead of raising interest rates? It's an alternative theory.
Well, of course, I don't know. But that sounds implausible to me. I mean, when it comes right down to it, the Chinese leadership is not all that straightforward to figure out. There's no open meeting laws in the Chinese government, and the Chinese also have a penchant for looking more long term than would be the case in countries where people are actually elected every so often. So it's a little hard to disentangle what might be motivating things. But for what it's worth, which probably isn't much, I think the reason why they're locking down is due to public health concerns primarily, and not some more convoluted strategy. These sorts of disruptions are one way of upsetting other people's apple cart, but it upsets their apple cart too. I kind of doubt that's what's motivating this. I think it's much more about the public health aspect. And don't forget, not only is China the biggest country by population, but darn near everybody in China lives on their East Coast. It's as if the whole population was from Maine to Florida. And the huge chunk that's to the west is like all Wyoming. So this is the public health issue there is a big deal, because you got people that are in such close proximity.
That's a very good point.
I can add a little bit to what Andy says in terms of China. And I kind of look at it this way. China doesn't have a Sherman Antitrust Act as a law. And so what we've seen is the Chinese government can literally tell the buyers to stop buying if they want to control inflation. They've got a lot more of a direct ability to affect pricing, to affect markets in China than we do in the US. I don't think they'd choose a lockdown to influence the inflation rate. It's implausible, to use Andy's term.
Those are very good pieces of insight. Mike Brown, this next question is for you. The audience member says, Mike mentioned carrying heavier inventory. Is that occurring across many companies, both domestically and internationally, especially in this tight market? And maybe the heavier inventory he was talking about was, you know, you want to stock up for butter in the fourth quarter. But if you want to expand on that a little bit.
I absolutely can. It's actually much broader than that. It's across the whole company. We basically have identified products where we are concerned on supply reliability. And so we're keeping more inventory so we have more time to recover. And for multiple reasons, everything from, I'll give you a good example. Industry-wide, on-time delivery for grocery stores fell below 50% for national brands. That means of the orders you made, 50% got there on time. And it's starting to creep back up, but then you find the glitches. And of course, COVID this winter had a big deal, but a lot of it is packaging availability. I mean, we're delaying a new product introduction on shelves because we can't get the box or the carton or the wrapping to put it in. Speaking of China, I would agree that I don't think China's trying to slow things down. They need the money and they need the commerce as well. And a lot of packaging today for domestic products comes out of China. And so there's a lot of people waiting. And one of the things, to Ted's point about them being I remember in economics you called benevolent dictators. I'm not really sure how benevolent they are, but it is a controlled economy and they prioritize. They say, you get to go out of port, you don't. You're more important, you're more revenue, or you've got the right guy in the political party supporting you. And so there's a lot of that as well, which adds to the unpredictability. But yeah, we are definitely carrying more inventory on a lot of products just because, you know, our goal is not to be out of stock on the shelves. And I would be dishonest to say that we haven't had out of stock issues, but at least we're not alone. It's misery loves company. The entire grocery business is struggling to keep shelves full.
Ted Galloway, from the other end, you're supplying a lot of retailers and restaurants in the United States. What are you gathering from inventory on their end?
It's quite interesting because from our, again, we're making sure they have the product. But let's take a restaurant example. People are used to going to their favorite, if it's a fast casual or quick service restaurant, having all the packaging themed. And most of these organizations, if they can get a straw, not necessarily a straw, the color of their themed restaurant, they're happy. And there have been times where there's no straws. Simple things as covers for the soft drinks or for, in our case, hopefully for the dairy dessert drink. They can't get covers. They can't get cups with their logos on. They can't get bags. Ketchup packets, it goes through their whole organization. When you look at our industrial manufacturing customers, and Mike's alluded to that several times, they're getting our product to manufacture the end product that would go into a Kroger's, but they can't get the packaging or the corrugate to put the end product in to get to the grocery stores, or they can't get the transportation. And as Mike mentioned, the on-time deliveries is more of a prayer than even a hope now. There are still extreme challenges in the industry to have everything work together. Only parts are really working right now.
We're going to move on to a next question here, and this is a follow-up to that conversation. I think Andy Novakovic, you're probably best to answer that, but for a retailer carrying heavier inventory, specifically for dairy, do these inventories show up on cold storage reports?
Well, it depends on where they're held. The cold storage reports, and for that matter, the dry storage reports, tend to survey commercial warehouses or the large warehouses that would be operated, say, by a manufacturer. If Mike is putting product away in a commercial warehouse that's part of the existing survey, it's going to show up just like anything else would. But different companies, I'm sure, along the supply chain are increasing their storage. And if they have their own warehouses or maybe storing it in some place that's not part of the normal storage network, not sure what that would be, but if such a thing were true, it would be missed. So it's not so much who's holding it, but where is it held?
I think the form of the product matters too. When you talk about cold storage, cheddar for aging isn't a cold storage number. I don't believe packaged butter is a cold storage number. And most of that is held in commercial, supermarket or local warehouses anyway. So it won't necessarily jive, but I would say generally there's probably a reasonable correlation if there's big inventories in warehouses there is here. Again, the big difference this year is getting it in a retail package. It's just much tougher. And that's what makes us really different from the dairy prices we had in 2014. We had very high dairy prices in 14. is that dairy prices are high. This time, everything is high and everything is scarce. And so no matter where, what you have a, when you have a block of cheese, everything from the wrapper, butter, the wrapper, the box, the trucker to get it to the warehouse, everything is short. And of course, some of us, I think most of us on this call, or a majority anyway, out of five, at least felt inflation a little bit. I know it was the price of gas when I was going to college in the early late 70s. But as far as everything being so tight at once and the supply constrictions, this is new, and we're all, and is it long-term, short-term? I mean, it's really difficult at this point to even speculate what that, what the case is going to be. It's pretty daunting.
So we were talking packaging about 5 minutes ago, and one of the options for retailers or anyone is you raise the prices on goods, or you raise the, or shrink the serving size, and that's not so easy right now. I know, you know, maybe Mike Brown wants to start, or Ted Galloway, or but if you wanted to change your packaging, it may be, it's quite a length of time. It could be 8 months, could be a year. Anyone want to jump in on that one?
Well, I'll start. It can be over a year right now. That's how crazy it is. And so you can't do that. I've joked for years, we're gonna get down to an ice cream container is a thimble full. You know, we went from a half gallon to and 50 whatever, 54 ounces to 48, and we continue, and will that happen again? We are seeing efforts to do that. We are seeing modest downsizes. In some cases, they're keeping it in the same package, just filling it less full. And you know, that consumers, that doesn't look very attractive to a consumer to see that. But for the most part, I would say we'd be seeing a lot more of that if it wasn't for the packaging, not just with Kroger, but with national brands as well. We do that as last resort. I think we were the last ice cream manufacturer in the country to leave a true half gallon to go to a 54. But it's one of those it's one of those things that again, unlike ever before, Corey, there are constrictions in supply so much along the chain. You just can't. It's not an automatic decision to do, because it may be, well, who knows, in a year and a half, we may be through all this. I hope we are. But things have really, really been delayed. We've seen that in some of the fluid beverages, and not necessarily milks, where we've seen shrinkage from, you know, 64 to 59, or in the case of a carton, or to 52 in the case of some other products. But we haven't had any recent changes in that. And the thing we keep hearing is you can't get the packaging. So we're going to keep selling you the 64 or the 59 for now, because we can't get anything smaller.
That is even steps in on changing ingredients, because some of our customers manufacturing for a finished product will request this. Can we substitute an ingredient that would save them some money? And it goes right back to what Mike was saying. That's great, but now you have to change your nutritionals that are pre-printed in your ingredient declaration, and you're 3/4 of a year to over a year out on that. Minus will not save the money right now.
That's an excellent point, Ted. I know there's several times we haven't done that recently for that very reason. It's the time to get the packaging changed.
So all our guests may give a very thoughtful answer to our final question. What might happen to dairy demand this fall? Give that some thought. And while you're, and we're going to go in the order that you joined the broadcast, there's one question here that Andy can answer. Will inflationary pressures make real milk more or less competitive in relation to alternative beverages such as almond or oat?
Well, you know, maybe my glasses are pink colored, but I'm relatively optimistic. When I think about those particular items, I mean, there's supply chain issues and packaging issues. They kind of cut across the board. That's not, doesn't make any difference if you're putting pea juice in a container or milk. But the, what I'm a little bit more wary of is the production conditions for making the raw material. I think we've got a ridiculously resilient dairy industry around the U.S., but a lot of these plant-based products are a lot more subject to fussy weather conditions. that and are only grown in certain areas, almond for sure, soy less so. So I think from the supply side, actually we're in better shape than a lot of those plant-based products would be, just from the standpoint of the raw materials.
Well, here's our final question. What might happen to dairy demand this fall? Mike Brown, go ahead, you're first.
Right now, our thoughts are because of, when you look at what affects demand, you can have obviously a price effect, you can have income effect, or just the fact of inflation, everything's more expensive, you have less disposable income to use. You can have obviously supply chain effects. There's all kinds of things that can affect it. We're working very hard to minimize supply chain impacts. Again, we're able to find dairy products. We're trying to build inventory when the products, obviously you aren't gonna do that with fluid milk, but with things that you can store. In case of butter, you can freeze it, then what they call temperate, and so you can store ahead, which we're doing. But I think there's a couple things I think that work for dairy. First of all the boats have risen. Cost of vegetable oils, cost of plant proteins, everything is through the roof. So it's not like we necessarily are competitively less advantaged. I mean, as you might imagine, Kroger manages butter and margarine as one section of the store. And as a dairy guy, I'm just very pleased to know that the oils are so expensive from the standpoint of competition, because they've actually had as big a cost on a percentage, much bigger than we've had in butter. The second thing I would say is that we're still, you talked about early on, Andy, on CPI. And what's happening with different food groups, we are still, for quality protein, the best buy. And we see that too. And so it's kind of, you look at, I remember when I took economics at Virginia Tech, Ag Econ, one of the examples we used was hot dogs. When the market, when prices are strong, when we have high inflation, people will move substitute down to some degree. And hot dogs actually, and it's true at Kroger, the correlation between meat costs and hot dog sales is inverse. When meat costs are high, hot dog sales drop. When they're low, they go up. Same with income effect when the economy's tough. I think we're very competitive from the standpoint of what we give the consumer for the price, and I think that will continue to help us through the fall. We're pretty confident dairy, it may decline a little bit, but it's going to be fairly stable, particularly if we can not move a lot higher than we already have.
Ted Galloway.
Pretty short, we're feeding America. Our components go into products all over the country. People are going to continue to eat, whether they're eating out or eating in. And we view that we're going to be part of that component, helping move dairy into the fall and into next year. So I think there's going to be other cuts made other than people consuming the food that our ingredients are going into.
Ted Jacoby.
So I think ultimately that's going to be a macroeconomic question. I would start with the question of how well is our economy going to hold up between now and the end of the year? And I think it's probably going to be fine, but I don't think we're going to see the kind of demand that we've seen in the last 6 months over the course of the next 6 to 9 months. I thought one of your questions was pretty apropos. You know, revenue amount spent on dairy is up 3%, but the units, you know, the amount actually sold in volume is down 3%. And I think that trend right about along those lines is probably gonna continue through the rest of the year. But here's the thing, supply is constricted. You know, we're down 1% in the US in milk production, and most of the conversations I have about what milk production is doing in any other milk shed in the world, it's down more than it is here. That's gonna create a base so that even though I think we're gonna see demand struggle a little bit, I don't think we're going to see prices drop drastically from where they are now. And in fact, when Mike Brown said he's looking at prices at about a 70% range or 70 cent range, which is much bigger than usual, I kind of thought, yeah, that range is probably about right, but the bottom of that range is a lot closer to current prices than the top of that range is. I think there's a lot of upside possibility if demand ends up being better than expected.
When I like to, Ted's spot on. when you're looking like us, trying to do the best we can to manage price, particularly dealing with merchandisers who don't even, they think risk management is gambling, which is always a good educational opportunity, I'll put it that way. It's often true with dairy, upside risk, if you're a buyer, is a lot bigger than downside opportunity. So to his point, when you look at that variance, it isn't even. We think there's a lot more risk of that big pop up than we are of a lot of relief on the downside, which affects our strategy. It also makes decisions to forward buy at a price you think may be a little bit elevated worth it, because you think your opportunity or your concern on much higher prices is big. It's a tricky time for everyone. If you, I always said this, if when people ask me what their price is going to be, I always say, well, if I knew what it would be, I wouldn't have a mortgage. Well, I just sold my second house, so I don't have a mortgage anymore, but I still don't know what the price is going to be.
Andy, if you could wrap it all together.
Well, speaking of wrap, one of the things I was going to say is, you know, is if everybody's wearing bandages, it's probably hard to feel good because you have fewer bandages than the next guy. Going forward, we're all going to feel a little beat up, but I'm with the other speakers. I think dairy is going to look better than a lot of other food items and a lot of other parts of the economy. Cheese is going to be, I think, a good buy compared to other animal proteins. I wish them no ill, but I think that's the way it is. I think, to Mike's hot dog example, we'll probably be seeing more sales of the hot dog version of cheese, so it'll change a little bit the composition. I think how well we support low-income households through government programs is going to make a pretty darn big difference in all of this. We'll see how that goes out politically. Limited service restaurants, fast food and other limited service restaurants, have a host of problems, and their prices are inflating more so than full service restaurants. That's a low-income venue more so. I think what that's going to do is pull back more people eating at home. Eating at home favors milk consumption. So there's a number of things that I think will be on the plus side for us, even though we've got a few band-aids stuck on.
Well, thank you very much. Our next dairy live stream, Can Dairy Product Exports Power Through Port Problems, will air on Wednesday, May 18th at 11 a.m. Central Daylight Time, and will be archived on the Hordes Dairyman YouTube and podcast channels the very next day. I look forward to seeing you then. And on behalf of Mike Brown, Ted Galloway, Ted Jacoby, and Andy Novakovic, I'm Corey Geiger, your host. Thank you for joining us today. We wish you all a good day. Bye, everyone.